Right then, brethren, we're going back to the topic of prophecy. Now, you might remember, if you've been with us for the last few months, that in the early part of the year, the first quarter of the year, we spent quite a bit of time on prophecy, particularly looking at the prophecies of the books of Daniel and Revelation. And I was offering an alternative view of whom the end time events might relate to, rather than our traditional view, the one that we've, you know, by and large accepted in the churches of God, which is that we're looking out for a revived Holy Roman Empire and 10 nations combining in Europe. I suggested that a plausible alternative, and I thought actually a much more reasonable explanation, is that God's warnings to us in the scripture are not about Rome and Europe, but about Islam and the major Islamic nations of the Middle East. Now, you know, many of us, probably most of us, have spent decades, you know, following events in Europe and the Vatican, looking for, you know, 10 nations that might come together and be the final beast empire. We've always assumed it would be somehow led by a very powerful Germany, perhaps with another Führer as the head honcho. And of course, you know, many people are still looking for that particular outcome. That's still where their eyes are focused. I mean, for example, you've got the Living Church of God, United Church of God, Philadelphia Church of God, the Restored Church of God, and most, but not all others, but most others, all looking towards Europe, 10 nations, a ruler, and all of it in association with the Roman Catholic Church and the Vatican. Not just the churches of God, I should say, but also very, very large numbers of the more traditional, born-again, you know, rapture-believing evangelicals. It's a very, very popular view. Well, okay, fair enough, but are we sure we're looking in the right place? What if the prophecies are actually pointing somewhere else and we're actually looking in the wrong direction? Now, that would be potentially a problem. So I do want to return to this topic again for perhaps a few weeks. I've had a few requests to go with material. That might be because it seemed a bit technical. I don't think it's overly technical, but you know, there's quite a lot, you know, there. And you know, certainly at times the symbolism of prophecy with you know, heads and horns and statues and beasts and seals and sea lions and who knows what not, it can get perhaps a wee bit complicated if you don't put it together. So I'm going to return to the topic. And also, to be fair, quite a lot has happened this year since I finished that series back in March. Two of the key players we discussed at the time, things have happened there. One was Turkey. A great deal has happened in the last few months in Turkey. It's looking currently all rather ominous. Also, another major player was Iran, or Persia, as the Bible refers to it, where again there's been significant developments. So it's just possible that this year has seen some significant steps towards the fulfillment of these end-time prophecies. And if we're looking elsewhere, we'll have missed them. So I think it's worth our while sort of going back over some of the key essentials so we can all remain alert just in case things are about to get interesting. But always with prophecy, we have to remember that it can be tricky. There are many churches and many experts who've got egg on their faces predicting events and dates, and it's all gone wrong. So we have to be, you know, careful. We can always seek to stick to the biblical narrative. And then see how world conditions fit in. But we have to accept, when it comes to prophecy in particular, we generally see through a glass darkly. So we take care. We try to be sensible and reasonable. And I suppose one question you might always want to ask before looking at prophecy is, well, what's the point? Aren't there more important things for believers to be doing rather than looking at prophecy? Shouldn't be, living right, for example, and looking at all the things about, being patient and generous and kind and being good at prayer and good at fasting. Well, maybe not that one. And isn't prophecy, after all, just a distraction? Should we even bother looking at prophecy? Well, let's open our Bibles at Matthew 16, read Jesus' comments, Matthew 16, and we read verses 1 through 3. Matthew chapter 16, beginning in verse 1. Then the Pharisees and Sadducees came and, testing Jesus, asked him that he would show them a sign from heaven. They wanted a sign, some evidence, something they could look at, which would convince them. He answered and said to them, "When it is evening, you say, 'It will be fair weather, for the sky is red.' In the morning, you say, 'It will be foul weather today, for the sky is red and threatening.' Hypocrites! You know how to discern the face of the sky, the signs in the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the times." You cannot discern, or one translation says, you cannot interpret the signs of the times. Now, what Jesus meant was, there are things happening, boys, all around you. And of course, he'd be having in mind there are things pointing to he himself as the prophesied Messiah. And you guys, you're hypocrites, you're pretenders. Jesus condemns them for not being aware of, identifying and understanding the signs of the times. They should have been more watchful, more alert. And of course, if Jesus criticized them for not discerning the signs of the times in their day, I guess we should take that as an encouragement that you and I should be watchful and alert to discern and interpret the signs of the times in our day. We shouldn't just ignore, dismiss, turn away from the signs of the times that are all around us. Jesus gave us prophecies for a reason, not just to fill out the Bible, make it a bigger book. They're there to give us advance notice, advance warning, advance instruction. For example, look at Matthew 24. That's the Olivet prophecy chapter. So the whole chapter pretty much is about Jesus giving us prophetic understanding or insight. So look here at Matthew 24. Let's read verses 13 to 16. "But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore, when you see..." So this is something you should be looking out for. This should be a sign of the times that you should be watchful and alert for. "When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place..." And then Matthew's added the words, "Whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." So here's Jesus saying, you should be familiar with the prophecies of Daniel. When you see the abomination that he described, those of you in Judea, you need to get out of there pronto, in a hurry. Now, fair enough, but if you're not familiar with the prophecies of Daniel, or prophecy full stop, if you're not watchful, then you won't see, you won't understand. So implicit in Jesus' comments is the need to be watching and alert for the signs of the times. And one sign is an abomination of desolation. Or drop down to verses 23 to 26. Then, in this latter time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, don't believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders so as to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. Well, that's prophecy. Explaining beforehand what is to come later is prophecy. And Jesus says, I'm warning you. There will be a day when people will be out there saying, go look for Christ here, go look for him there. They'll show great signs, great wonders, great miracles, and they're going to seek to deceive you, but I'm warning you here today, when that time comes, watch out. Be alert. I'm giving you a heads up before time. Now, if we're not familiar with Jesus' heads up, whether it's in Matthew 24 or in other places or in the prophecies that he inspired in the Old Testament scriptures, then what was the point of giving them? You know, we're so smart we don't need the warnings that have been laid down there and preserved for millennia. Look at verses 32 and 33, same chapter, verses 32 and 33. Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near, because you can see the signs. Trees are pretty, you know, dead in the winter, just all rather stark, just empty, you know, branches, nothing happening. But as you get towards springtime and early summer, suddenly, you know, life appears. You know, leaves shoot out and little buds appear, flowers and so on. When you see these signs, you know that summer's near, verse 33. So you also, when you see all these things that he's been speaking about, know that it is near at the very doors. But you can't see these things of A, you don't know what these things are, because you've paid no attention to prophecy, and you won't see them if you're not alert and watchful and aware of what's going on. So, you know, there's quite a number of places where Jesus explains what to look for, that you and I should be watchful and alert. And obviously, there are many, many prophecies in the scriptures about the end time. So hopefully, you know, all of us are, you know, looking forward to Jesus' return to the world tomorrow. That's what the Feast of Tabernacles will shortly be keeping, you know, points to and some pictures. And in a sense, you might think that you and I would get, you know, quite excited by the signs of the times as we see them happening, thinking, ooh, this looks interesting, ominous, frightening, exciting, and even start to lift our hopes. I think this is it. I think the signs are there. Now, of course, prophecy being prophecy, we have to maintain our balance. But then the question becomes, well, yeah, but what signs should we be looking for? Should we be looking towards Europe? Towards Rome and the Vatican and Roman Catholic Church? Should we be looking for things there? Is that the place to focus our attention? Will we see the signs that prophecy reflects happening in Europe? Or perhaps should it be Islam and Iran and Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Egypt? You know, where should we be looking to pick up on these signs of the times? Now, there's always going to be a certain element of you know, speculation when it comes to prophecy. You can't really avoid that. But we can certainly try and stick as closely as we can to the biblical narrative, try to be very familiar with what the Bible actually says, and then hopefully be fairly responsible in trying to interpret world events in the light of what the Bible says. And we won't be perfect, and there'll be a bit of speculation here and there. Hopefully it'll be obvious when we're speculating, and we'll leave a bit of wriggle room. But okay, let's ask the big question now. The traditional view is Rome. Although usually when we say Rome, we actually mean, you know, Western Europe and sort of Germany. So we're a bit loose already with our sort of terminology. But we mean, you know, Rome as a sort of key part of Europe. And that comes from essentially three biblical passages. You know, why choose Rome? Why Europe? Why have we always looked there? The answer is there are three main biblical passages. And we're going to look at each one now and see whether, taking it at face value, whether these passages clearly, strongly point the finger at Rome, brackets, meaning in our case, Western Europe, close brackets, or whether, really? Rome? Oh, I don't know. It's sort of a bit weak. Not really sure when you challenge that, if it really stacks up. So we'll look at these three passages. And once you've left these three passages, there's not much else. I mean, this basically is it. So if at the end of today's Bible study, we've looked at these three passages, and we all think, you know what? Rome, clear. It's conclusive. There's no doubt in my mind it's Rome or Europe and Germany. Fine. I mean, I've not got a problem with that. From my perspective, I can't see it. You actually look at these three passages and challenge them and put them to the test. I think it's very, very weak. That's my view. And obviously, you pay your money and you take your chances. All right, okay, let's start in Daniel chapter 2. Book of Daniel's a key prophecy, which is right there where Jesus refers to Daniel. You know, some people say that Daniel wasn't there at all. It's a made-up book written centuries later by various unknown, you know, Jewish writers who've been, you know, smoking pot or something. But, you know, Jesus said, blah, 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 book of Daniel. So Daniel was real, and he was there, and he did write under inspiration. Here's a prophecy, an important prophecy in many, many ways. It's a dream that King Nebuchadnezzar had of this great statue made of different metals. And Nebuchadnezzar was astonished by his dream, wanted to know what it meant. And it turns out, of course, Daniel's the only guy who can bring the understanding. We'll pick up in verse 31. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image, like a statue. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs, that's going to be from the knees downward, because the thighs were bronze, its legs, namely knees downwards, of iron, his feet, partly iron and partly clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay, broke them in pieces. Then the iron, clay, bronze, silver, gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So the stone smashes the statue on its feet. Statue topples over, crushes, smashes, gets pulverized, breaks up. Wind blows it all away. You can't see it. And the stone swells and grows, becomes a huge mountain that fills the earth. Now, I think we pretty much know the meaning of all this anyway, but let's carry on. This is a dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand, has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. Pretty plain. And Nebuchadnezzar is king of Babylon. So the king, or the kingdom, those terms are interchangeable, represents the kingdom, the empire of Babylon, the head of gold. Fair enough. Verse 39. And of course, Nebuchadnezzar is very curious as to, when I'm gone, what happens? What happens to my empire? What happens to all this territory that I rule? When I'm gone, what comes next? And he's got the story here for his benefit, but actually, of course, essentially for those of us in the latter days. After you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, Then another third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. Earth meaning, by the way, not South America, Central America, China, Japan, because that obviously never, ever, ever happened. It's the part of the earth to which the prophecy relates. And this is largely sort of the Middle Eastern area. So here's a silver represents another kingdom coming after Babylon, which everybody knows and agrees is Medo-Persia. Then the third kingdom of bronze, which everybody knows, is Greece. It's and there's general agreement on that, but the debatable one, well, we're going to debate it anyway, is the fourth one, verse 40. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. This is a destructive kingdom, this fourth one. Verse 41, whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay, partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron, partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong, partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron and clay do mix. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, its interpretation is sure. So that's the dream, that's the interpretation of it. We're talking of 1, 2, 3, 4 kingdoms or empires, and the fourth one will be replaced by God's kingdom, which of course will be a real kingdom, just as the previous four were real kingdoms. It'll be a real kingdom on the earth, just as the first four were real kingdoms on the earth. I'm not talking about, you know, up in heaven, gazing at some beatific vision. You know, God's kingdom is on the earth. It's real, it's got territory and subjects and laws and a king, King Jesus. So here we are. Now, traditionally, the view of these four metals is clearly the gold is Babylon, and that's not, you can't argue there. That was Babylon, which ran from about 625 BC to 538 BC. Dates don't matter too much. Replaced by Medo-Persia, roughly 558 to 330 BC. Again, not overly important, the exact dates. Replaced by Greece, roughly 333 BC to sort of 31 BC. And then, the fourth Iron Empire is Rome, running from about 31 BC to about 476 AD. A Roman Empire, which other passages tell us will be followed by 10 resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire, of which 9 have come and gone already. This is our traditional view, in case you don't recognize it. You haven't perhaps studied your old books and booklets recently, but that's what we would have once upon a time said. The last of the 9 have come and gone, the last one being the resurrection of the empire under Mussolini, of course that's Italy, and Hitler, of course Germany, and then there's one more to come. And we're all waiting with bated breath for the final 10th resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, being Europe, led by Germany, in cahoots with the Vatican. That's where we've been. You should know that. Well, there's no real argument over the first 1, 2, and 3, but the fourth one, the iron legs, that empire, does it fit Rome? Well, it's an absolutely key. This is the main passage. There's two other passages we'll look at. This is the key one. This is the main one. This is the one that sets the direction for everybody else. This is where the whole story of looking at Europe comes from, right? So let's just test whether the scriptures we're reading here point definitely, conclusively to Rome. Look at Daniel 2:40. The fourth kingdom. What does it tell us about the fourth kingdom? Well, it'll be strong as iron. Okay, you know, certainly could be Rome. No problem there. Inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the other kingdoms. So there's a description of what this kingdom will do. It will break in pieces and crush all the others. So we're going to think about that in a moment. But you don't need to think about it, because actually, at least one translation of the Bible actually now puts the explanation in the scriptures. Daniel 2:40 in the Amplified translation, it takes away all the arguing. The Amplified says, verse 40, then a fourth kingdom, brackets Rome, brackets, will be strong as iron. So there you are. But the Bible tells you it's Rome. Well, the Amplified translation tells you it's Rome, but I think the Amplified translation is not right. Now, the idea that it's Rome goes back a long, long way. It appears that the first person to identify Daniel 2:40, the fourth empire of iron, as Rome was a gentleman called Hippolytus, H-I-P-P-O, as in Hippo, and Lytus, L-Y-T-U-S, Hippolytus, who wrote round about 200 AD, it's quite a long time ago, and he said, quotes, the legs of iron expressed the Romans, who had the sovereignty at the moment. So his view was, yep, the legs of iron, Rome. He also thought that Jesus would return by 500 AD. So he was wrong in the latter, but was he wrong about the former? Well, I'm not going to blame Mr. Hippolytus, because, you know, as he's, you know, sitting there in 200 AD, as he looks around, you know, Europe and the world as he knows it, the Roman Empire is still strong, powerful. Emperors, armies, military, trade, wealth. So he's just thinking, well, you know, I saw Babylon and I could see Medo-Persia. I could see then Greece, and we came next as Roman Empire chappies, so it's clearly Rome. Another major author and Bible scholar, a guy called Jerome, he's the guy that produced the Latin Vulgate verse in the Bible, which was used by Europe for the next 1,000 years. He said in his commentary on Daniel, quotes, now the fourth empire, which clearly refers to the Romans, is the Iron Empire, which breaks in pieces and overcomes all others. So Jerome, yeah, it's quite clear, writing in, you know, roughly 400 AD, is Rome. How could you argue with that? Again, I'm not going to criticize the guy, because when he looked around, that's sort of what he saw. But even right up into modern times, there's a well-known author called Hal Lindsey, who wrote one of the best-selling books of the 1970s, of the late great Planet Earth. He said, Rome. The Seventh-day Adventists say it's Rome. The Churches of God say it's Rome. And lots of mainstream commentaries say it's Rome. But let's look again at verse 40 there. The latter part. That kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. This describes what this fourth kingdom will do. Some other translations, just to bring out the language a bit better, the Good News Bible says it will shatter and crush all the earlier empires. So this fourth empire will crush, smash, pulverize Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. So it says. That's not an interpretation, that's what the verse says. The Holman Christian Standard Bible translation says it will crush and smash all the others. Well, I think we know what that means, don't we? To crush, to smash, to pulverize, to break in pieces. You take an item of crockery, you know, a cup or a saucer or a plate out of your kitchen cupboard, and you smash it into bits.
You better know.
It's 100 fragments. You couldn't rebuild it. It's smashed, pulverized, crushed. The Hebrew word is dekak, D-E-Q-A-Q, the way we write in English, which means what it says, break into pieces, be shattered. So, here's the question. Did Rome shatter, break in pieces, pulverize, crush Babylon and Persia and Greece? Because if it's a prophesied fourth empire, it must have done. Because the prophecy is going to be right. And of course, the embarrassing answer is no. Rome didn't do that. For example, Rome never, ever conquered Persia. They battled a bit, but Rome never had the victory. So hold on a second. The Fourth Empire crushes and shatters and pulverizes, but Rome didn't do any of that with regard to Persia. Oops. What about Greece? Well, yes, Rome certainly conquered Greece, no question. But did they shatter it? Crush it? Pulverize it? Actually, no, somewhat the reverse. The Romans respected, admired Greek culture, Greek religion, Greek architecture, and they borrowed lots of it. Look at many Roman buildings, public buildings, and they copy the architecture of Greece. They imported lots of Greek gods and goddesses and myths. So whilst they might have conquered Greece, they didn't destroy. In fact, the Romans weren't in some ways that destructive. Typically, they set countries up to be more prosperous because they, of course, taxed them. And you want more wealth, you need countries that are going to be run quite well. So it's quite easy to say, well, you get Babylon, then you get Persia, then you get Greece, then you get Rome. No, it doesn't fit the description of Daniel 2:40. And if you look at a map, which we can't do, obviously, on air, but you can get into a, you know, look at Google or something, stick up, you know, Roman Empire, stick up a Babylonian Empire, Persian Empire, etc., you'll see that Rome basically is Western Europe. The Roman Empire was, in the main, Western Europe, just getting slightly into sort of Palestine, whereas Babylon and Persia are way to the east, not even in the same areas. You know, Babylon and Persia are about 1,000 to 1,500 miles east of the Roman Empire. So Rome didn't occupy the territories that Nebuchadnezzar was interested in, didn't crush them. So really, at face value, this doesn't fit Rome. Break in pieces means break in pieces. For example, look at Daniel 2:44. In the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and God's kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces, same word, dekak, and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So, same word, break in pieces, shatter, pulverize, crush. So, what do you think? Do you think that God's kingdom will leave all these other nations out entirely? Think God's kingdom will honor and respect their cultures, their laws and religions? No. It says God's kingdom breaks in pieces and smashes. It's like the statue topples over. It shatters and the wind blows it all away. You can't see it any longer. It's gone. That's what the fourth kingdom does to Babylon, to Persia, to Greece. And Rome didn't do that. So would you say there's a strong pointer from, you know, the Iron Empire, the legs of iron? Does that point strongly, conclusively to Rome? I think it doesn't point even remotely to Rome. Rome doesn't fit. Got the wrong culprit there. However, I would suggest, just suggest for now, but there's information to come later, that it does point to Islam, the Islamic empires. Because today, Babylon, we call Iraq, which of course is an Islamic country today and has been Islamic for many, 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 many centuries. Persia, you know, the kingdom of silver, is today known as Iran, which is Islamic, has been for many, many, many centuries. Greece, well, Greece, slightly awkward there. Greece is actually the Hebrew word Javan, or Yavan, J-A-V-A-N or Y-A-V-E-N, and that largely relates to Turkey and some of the countries around the edge of Turkey. And of course, Turkey is Islamic and has been for many, many, many centuries. So the Islamic Empire, starting in the 7th century, spread rapidly across all the Middle East, all of North Africa, and even right across parts of Europe, right up to and including Spain and parts of France. The Islamic Empire was bigger than all the rest put together. So more to come, but I would suggest at the moment that this passage is far more convincing if you apply it to the Islamic Empire, because when it came to Babylon, Persia, and Javan, Turkey, it crushed, it pulverized, it did away with their religions, with their cultures. It took over, and even today, you know, 1,000 years later, these countries are still under Islamic rule, Sharia law, honoring Allah and his prophet Muhammad, and Allah is, of course, none other than Satan. So pointing to Rome, I think that's shaky. And then, of course, if it's inaccurate, if our view that this is pointing to Roman Europe is inaccurate, then all the follow-up teachings about the 10 resurrections of the Roman Empire are wrong. Our thoughts about a United States of Europe being rebuilt in the old Roman Empire territory is wrong. It all becomes highly suspect. Now, there's no question that today, if you look at Europe, it's a very, very troubled continent. Economically, there's a lot of problems between various parts of Europe. The politics, a bit of a nightmare. They're struggling at every sort of level currently with Muslim immigration, but lots of other things as well. There may well be dramatic developments across Europe. You know, the UK has recently voted to leave the EU. They call it Brexit. Other countries might perhaps follow. But just because Europe is troubled doesn't mean the prophecies of Daniel and Revelation are being fulfilled. It's almost just business as usual that Europe's struggling. So that's possibly, would you believe it, that's the key passage. That's the main one. That's one that's going to convince you that we have to look to Rome and Europe and 10 nations in Europe in cahoots with the Catholic Church, based upon the iron legs. And you think, did Rome ever pulverize, crush, and shatter all the others? No. Therefore, in my view, Rome fails the test. Okay, second passage, which is a lot weaker, I would have thought, is Revelation 17. So let's turn to Revelation 17, picking up in verses 3 and 4. 3, 4, 9. So that was a strong one we just did. This next one is, I think that's fairly obviously wrong, got to say. But this one is even weaker. This one, I think, is so weak, it's almost embarrassed. I think you'd be embarrassed to use it. But
it needs crutches to get it.
People do use it, so, you know. Verses 3 and what do I say? 3 and 4, Revelation 17. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. So here's a prophecy of a woman and a red beast, the red beast having 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. So another time we'll look at the woman on this red scarlet beast, but drop down to verse 9. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits. Aha! There you are. That's Rome. excuse me? The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits. And the way it's generally thrown at you is, well, everybody knows Rome's a city on 7 hills. So, end of, yeah, I rest my case, my lad. Right? There's proof, obvious, definite. And Mr. Gunnar Armstrong, in his article many years ago, Who is the Antichrist?, was just expressing the view of the, you know, the worldwide Church of God of the day, and equally the view, I've got to say, of many others, not just a Church of God thing. Mr. Armstrong says, quotes, notice the, this is embarrassing, Mr. Armstrong, notice the incontrovertible evidence of her location. In Revelation 17:9, Rome is famous for its 7 hills. Yeah? And how do we connect these two passages? Incontrovertible? Well, actually, lots of cities have got 7 hills. Wikipedia will list dozens and dozens for your amusement. San Francisco has 7 hills. Seattle. And you say, well, that's not very biblical. Well, okay, fair enough. But Jerusalem has 7 hills. And that's biblical, isn't it? Mecca has 7 hills. And if Islam is what we're on about, then, could this be possibly Mecca? Also Istanbul, the capital of, well, it's not the capital exactly of Turkey. Ankara is a civil capital, but it's the biggest, best known, and it was once upon a time Constantinople. That's good. 7 hills. So we can simply say, well, Revelation 17:9 says 7 hills, it must be Rome. Well, actually, it doesn't say 7 hills, does it? Have a look at it. It says the 7 heads are 7 mountains. Now, I can climb hills quite easily. I'm not going to be too good at climbing mountains, I've got to say. Right? And they're different. They're different in English, they're different in Greek. Mountains is a Greek word, oros, O-R-O-S, O-R-O-S, oros. Hills, a different Greek word, bunos, B-O-U-N-O-S, bunos. And the harlot, the woman, sits on 7 mountains. Not 7 hills at all. And then, as you think, oh, I wonder what a mountain might be. Well, actually, read verse 10. Verse 10, there are also 7 kings. 5 have fallen. 1 is, and the other has not yet come. When he comes, he must continue a short time. So verse 9 says, the 7 heads are 7 mountains. Verse 10 says, there are also 7 kings. Those are actually all linked together in one sentence. The New American Standard Bible makes it a bit plainer than the New King James. Quotes, the 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the moon sits, and they are 7 kings, or 7 kingdoms. So the 7 mountains represent 7 kingdoms. You remember just a few minutes ago, if you're paying attention, we read Daniel 2:35, which says, and the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. That stone becoming a great mountain pictures God's kingdom. A mountain in a number of places in Scripture represents a king or a kingdom. So Revelation 17:9 is not identifying a location, right? You can't prove this is Rome. How can you prove that's Rome? The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits, and they are also 7 kings. 5 are fallen, 1 is, and 1's yet to come. So what we're saying here, 7 mountains, so 5 mountains have fallen. There's 1 mountain left. Another mountain's going to pop up. You know, what are we on about? And it wasn't just, to be fair, wasn't just Garnet Armstrong and the Church of God. It's very popular with people who take the traditional Roman view. For example, a guy called Dave Hunt, quite a popular author on biblical things. He wrote a book entitled A Woman Rides the Beast, which, of course, is exactly what Revelation 17 is on about, the woman riding the scarlet beast. You can still buy it on Amazon. So if you want a copy, feel free. I think it's quite a big book. And he says, quotes, "The woman is that great city. Furthermore, she is built on seven hills." It's not actually true. "Only one city has for more than 2,000 years been known as a city on seven hills. That city is Rome." No. Lots of cities are on seven hills. These are seven mountains. Five of them have fallen. One is, and one is yet to come. So, you know what? Using these first two passages, Daniel 2, Revelation 17, to say absolutely, categorically, beyond dispute, we're talking of Rome, personally, very, very unconvincing. And then there's one other passage, which is Daniel 9. So let's go over there. This is the third and final passage. There might be others. I'm not sure. These are the ones certainly you'll always see thrown at you, saying it must be Rome, must be Europe, must be 10 nations in Europe, must be Germany leading them, looking for a sort of a, some antichrist to come out of the former Roman Empire. This is the third one. After this, if there are any, they must be even weaker, so I wouldn't bother with them. So Daniel 9, picking up in verse 24 through 27. This is a slightly trickier little passage, but the bit we're going to look for is only one little bit of it, so we'll not get distracted by the rest. This is Daniel, of course, more prophecies from the angel, giving them to Daniel to give him an understanding of the future of the Jewish people. 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city, which would be clearly Jerusalem. 70 weeks, the Hebrew there is Shabua, so it's 70, and Shabua means seven, so 70 sevens are determined for your people. So in prophecy, we typically take a day as a year. So 70 some weeks is 490 years set apart, cut off for your city and your people, Daniel, to finish the transgression, make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. So good things are going to happen at the end of this 70 times 7 period. "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall even in troublesome times." So there is a built-in prophecy there about when to expect Messiah to arrive. We're going to ignore that. Verse 26. This is probably the key verse for us. "And after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself." That's going to be the crucifixion of Jesus, cut off, not for himself, but for the benefit of others like you and me. And here we go. "And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood until the end of the war, desolations are determined." Well, the key part for us just here is the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The people of the prince who is to come shall destroy Jerusalem and the temple. Who destroyed Jerusalem and the temple? Well, the Romans, right? And that's where the idea that this prince who is to come at the very end, often referred to as the Antichrist, that the Antichrist, this prince who is to come, must be a Roman, because the people who destroyed Jerusalem, the temple, were the Romans. Hold that. That's the sort of thinking there, right? I'll just finish off verse 27. "Then he," which he, you might wonder, and we've been through that in times past. I'm going to say it's this wicked prince at the end. He shall confirm a covenant with many for a week or 7 years. In the middle of the week, halfway through the seven-year period, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate. I'm going to say that's the abomination of desolation being set up halfway through the seven-year contract, this seven-year treaty. Anyway, that's all irrelevant. The key thing is, the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Well, everybody knows, don't they, that it was the Romans. Therefore, the Antichrist person, the prince who is to come, must be Roman, or at least European, maybe German. You know, it's always a bit sort of loose, the way we use the terminology there. We all know that it was the Romans that were occupying, you know, Jerusalem and Palestine in those days. And, of course, the Jews were often revolting and provocative. And, yes, indeed, in the late 60s AD, heading up to 70 AD, General Titus, a Roman general, and latterly became emperor a few years later, brought his armies down to sort the Jews out and to restore, you know, order and Roman authority. Things went wrong. There is historical evidence that he did not want to be too destructive, certainly not of the temple, which was a very, very, very important, you know, religious edifice. But despite his best endeavours, the temple was torched. His legions totally went out of control. He was unable to restrain them. And, of course, there was massive destruction, massive loss of life, and the temple was, well, disappeared. So clearly, the end-time prince who is to come must be a Roman. The final Antichrist must be a Roman, so therefore everything else must be European. That proves that Daniel 2:40 must be talking of Rome, because the final Antichrist is a Roman. Well, no, not quite. It says the prince who is to come comes from the people who destroy the city and the sanctuary, right? Verse 26, the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the temple. Question, who were the people who actually destroyed the city and the temple? Who were those people? The answer is the people that what done it, people who did it, were four Roman legions. Legions number 5, 10, 12, and 15, or properly V, X, XII, and XV, if you like your Latin. Four legions under Titus. Now, the point is that actually the Romans generally recruited locally for their campaigns. They didn't normally ferry people born in Rome all around the empire. They took advantage of local manpower, local knowledge and expertise. And actually, many, many legions were not Romans at all by birth. They were local conscripts. And guess what? Legions 5, 10, 12, and 15 were locals, or relatively local. Josephus was a Jewish historian who was there at the time of the fall of Jerusalem. He was an eyewitness of the battles, and he identifies those four legions being made up of essentially Syrians, Syria just, of course, north of Israel, and Arabians, Arabs. And historical records of how they were made up, those legions, shows that they were largely Syrian and Egyptian. And, of course, if you think of today, Syrians are Islamic, Egyptians are Islamic, and Arabs are Islamic. So, actually, when it says here, the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, the prince who is to come must come from Islamic peoples. Because it was Arab and Syrian and Egyptians who actually destroyed the temple. In fact, that's one of the reasons he went wild. You know, Titus was a soldier, sensible. He could see the need to maintain the Jews' place of worship. It was a very beautiful building, of course. But when you're talking of people who hated the Jews then, pretty much as they do today, the Syrians who despised the Jews, the Egyptians who despised them, once these guys, who were largely mercenary types, started, the bloodlust was there. So, if Daniel 9:26 is identifying the ethnic group from which the Antichrist will come, then you're looking at Syria, or Egypt, or at least an Arab country. Not Rome. Not Rome. The people who destroyed the sanctuary and the temple were Arab, Egyptian, Syrian, according to eyewitness and according to the makeup of the those four legions. So, looking at these three passages, and these are the three key ones, is there any link at all to Europe? I don't think so. Yet there are pointers to the Middle East and to Islam. Now, I said earlier that the fourth empire of Daniel 2, it could more likely be the Islamic Empire. I didn't give you any evidence of that, of course, just said that seems more likely. Well, there's some things we can do, some just in terms of looking at information that's out there in the public domain, and then looking at some scriptures. But you could, for example, try Google, right? If you go to Google, you know what Google is, right? And look at Google Images and stick in, let's say, Islamic Empire, 750 AD, let's say, or stick in Ottoman Empire, 1600 AD, you'll find out that the Islamic Empire and the Ottoman Empire, which is same beast, covers all of North Africa, all of the Middle East, including the gold and silver, including Babylon and Persia, all of the Saudi Peninsula, all of Turkey and Greece and Eastern Europe, right up to Austria. In other words, you look on the maps that are there and you see the Islamic Empire straddled a massive portion of the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe, and destroyed existing cultures and religions, brought them all under Sharia law and worship of Allah. Also, records suggest, this number I think must be an estimate, but suggests that roughly 270 million people have been killed in Islamic jihad. That's a quarter of a billion people have been slaughtered as the Islamic jihadists have moved out over 1400 years. Of course, that's not this year, you understand. But since 9/11, which has just been a commemoration the past few days, there have been 29,000 jihadist attacks, all motivated by Islam. Islam is a very, very active philosophy. You know, the Islamic religion, stated in the Quran, this is not just, made up by people who are whinging a bit, this is what's in the Quran itself, there's an imperative. They have to bring the whole world into subjection. There are only three options allowed, right? The Quran, the writings given to Muhammad, only three things can happen. One, you convert to Islam. Two, if you don't, you accept humiliation and subjugation, and you pay a poll tax annually called the jizya, J-I-Z-Y-A. So you go either convert or accept being humiliated permanently for the rest of your life and pay an annual tax as a humiliated person, which they call the jizya. Or third option, if you don't want to convert, don't want to be humiliated, subjugated and pay the tax, your third option is to be killed. That's it. And, devout Muslims who really believe in the teachings of Muhammad, that's their objective. The whole world will either convert, be subjugated, or be dead. Right? Now, some Muslims believe in an evolution over time. We can take a few decades, and you know, by education, by slow conversion, by getting control of the media, entertainment, schools and universities, government, we can gradually bring Islam into being the major force in every country. They've succeeded so far, by the way, in most countries. Or the other view is not gradual evolution, but violent revolution. The sword. And, of course, there's quite a few out there that think that's the best way. Now, clearly the Bible was written and completed a long time before Islam arose. You know, Muhammad didn't come around until about the 600s AD, so you won't find any specific mention of Islam, you know, by name, because how could you? It wasn't around for, you know, a few centuries. But it does identify in the Bible, you know, many countries in prophecy. And today we find the key countries, the ones prophesied, are mainly Islamic. And a good illustration we can find in Daniel 8, if we turn there, because this appears to be a major prophecy and potentially the next one to happen. So let's look at Daniel 8. Daniel, again, the prophet that Jesus said we should be familiar with, the abomination of desolation mentioned by Daniel the prophet. And when you see it, take action. Well, here's Daniel with another vision. Let's read verses 1 to 4. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me Daniel, after the one that appeared the first time. I saw in the vision, and it so happened, while I was looking, I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted my eyes and saw it, and there, standing beside the river, was a ram which had two horns. Okay, a ram with two horns. The two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the high one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, southward, doesn't mention going east. I think this is all specific and prophetic and clear. It's got meaning. It doesn't go east. It does go north, south, and west. So that no beast, no other animal, no other nation could withstand him. Nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. So here's the ram with two horns. Right? Who is the ram? Verse 20 tells us. The ram which you saw, having the two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia. Well, Medo-Persia is Iran. So this is a prophecy of Iran. Was it for olden days, or might it be for today? Well, verse 17. He came near the angel where I stood. When he came, I was afraid, fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, you know, Daniel, son of man, the vision refers to the time of the end. Look at verse 26. The vision of the evening and mornings, which was told, is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, Daniel, for it refers to many days in the future. So, the vision of Iran going north and south and west is a vision for the end of time. Now, if you look in the map, again, Google's quite handy, you'll find that north of Iran, north of the Ram, is southern Russia, such as Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, a few other stands. If you look west, you've got Iraq, Syria, Turkey. If you look south, you've got Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf states. And that entire region, particularly the southern part, is critical for oil. Persian Gulf? Oil? Oh, yeah. And any serious warfare in that region would lead to major economic problems worldwide, potentially collapse of the dollar, the euro, the pound, Japanese yen. And Iran, or the Ram, is Islamic. It's the Shia version of Islam. And the Shias believe they are the true version. Like you got all those one and only true churches of God out there, busy pointing fingers and castigating the other apostates. Islam's the same. Shias, like Islam, like Iran, believe that most other Muslims are apostates. Those are called Sunnis, typically. Now, the ram has got two horns, and horns symbolize usually power or authority. And we said before, speculating that the two horns of Iran might be one, the supreme leader full stop, but particularly he's religious, the Ayatollah. And the other horn, potentially, speculating, might be the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC. That's a major security spy organization. It's a fighting force. It's got 125,000 military men. Its purpose is to protect Iranian Islam. It also looks after the ballistic missile program. It supports other terrorist organizations. Potentially, it's quite a nasty bunch. Right? And the Ayatollah set it up to protect him and Islam. So those are the two biggest, most critical powers in Iran today. The IRGC was set up by the Ayatollah. It came later. This prophecy suggests it will become stronger at some point. So somewhere around the future days, the end time, you and I can look at Iran launching an attack across the other Middle East countries. Could be soon. Now, for quite a few years, Iran's been struggling financially, strapped for cash, because the USA, has been leading worldwide economic sanctions against Iran. Iran sponsors terrorism. And, of course, equally, it's been busy developing nuclear weapons. They deny that, of course, but everybody knows that's what they're doing. But their economy has really tanked in that time. Progress has been very slow. But this year, it's all changed, right? Because thanks to Mr. Obama, yes, indeed, they can now accelerate their vision. Because this year, Mr. Obama has entered into a deal with Iran. If they would agree to sort of to slow down their nuclear program, to put it into pause mode for 10 years, he would end the sanctions. And of course, they were totally strapped for cash. The average citizen in Iran was really struggling, getting a little bit so agitated about their government, but no problem. Mr. Obama and his administration have freed things up. Now, at least $33.6 billion has been returned to Iran, or up to $150 billion, depends which report you read, has been released. That's a lot of money to a country that sponsors terrorism. And, now causing some embarrassment the last few weeks, it's been admitted that two planes carrying $1.7 billion in banknotes were delivered in January this year. Not just talking of bank transfers, actually pallets loaded with $1.7 billion in various foreign currencies were delivered, I think, by two planes to Iran in January. And suspicion is growing by the day that may have been actually delivered to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is essentially a terrorist organization. Would Mr. Obama have done that? Well, Senator Marco Rubio, a Republican from Florida, has been demanding answers this past week. Where did that money go? Who was there? Who collected $1.7 billion worth of banknotes from America? And it turns out in the last week or two, suddenly the nuclear deal appears to be unraveling. because it turns out Iran didn't actually comply with its requirements. Oh, shock, amazement, says Jamie. It turns out that, unknown to nearly everybody, Mr. Obama and his team had agreed a number of side agreements which were not published and actually, in essence, negate all the so-called headline promises. One commentator says, quotes, "It's a colossal failure on every level." So Mr. Obama has cancelled the sanctions, released anywhere up to $150 billion to fund the prophetic ram, permitting it to more easily fulfil its regional ambitions on the back of a deal which turns out to be somewhat one-sided. The Iranians do nothing but thumb their noses, and America releases $150 billion. That's this year. That's this year. So the ram, it's free to go. He wants to go. It's got the money. Thank you, Mr. White House. Okay, let's read on Daniel 8, verses 5 through 8.
The he-goat.
The he-goat. "As I was considering, suddenly a male goat, a he-goat, came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn," a particularly notable authority figure or powerful figure, "between his eyes. He came to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, ran at him with furious power, and I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, broke his two horns.
Oh dear.
There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand." Whew, this he-goat is an angry goat, powerful goat, on the warpath goat, and he's going to kick the stuffing out of Iran, technical term. So who is the he-goat? Well, verse 21, "The male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn is between, the large horn that's between its eyes is the first king." Well, Greece is Javan or Yavan in Hebrew, which is largely the territory that is now occupied today by Turkey. It includes around the edges bits of Macedonia, Albania, bits of Greece. But to me today, the area of Turkey, I've got a map somewhere, I might stick it up on the website, which sort of shows Javan in that area. When is it? The end time. So here we have what appears to be a Turkish-led coalition, which launches a major, ruthless, brutal counteroffensive against Iran. In the end time. Maybe. Quite soon. Now, if you think about Turkey, Turkey is a major Islamic nation. Sunni Islam. The sort that Iran doesn't like. Turkey is the 10th most powerful military in the world. Not some, you know, dopey little country with people running around in, you know, donkeys. It's the second biggest military in NATO. There are possibly 50 or thereabouts B-61 nuclear gravity bombs in Turkey. They're owned by the US of A. They've been stationed in Turkey for quite a number of years to help defend, Europe. But now the USA is getting extremely nervous about Turkey and what's happened this year in Turkey. This massive shift towards Islamic ideals. And the rumours, yet to be corroborated, are that the US of A has been quietly moving its nuclear weapons out of Turkey and into Romania. Now, you can't get confirmation of that, but it's, you know, have a look at Google again. Now, Turkey is Sunni Islam. That's hostile to Iran's Shia Islam, because, of course, the Sunnis believe they're the one and only true Islam. Now, Turkey is the basis of the old Ottoman Empire. And we'll cover some of this in future, but the Ottoman Empire, major empire, one of the longest surviving empires on the earth. It ran from 1300 to 1922. That's like over 600 years. Islamic Empire. It ruled most of the Middle East, North Africa, Eastern Europe. It's a massive empire full of pomp and glory. And many, would you believe, in Turkey today want to restore the Islamic Ottoman Empire. That's the vision of the he-goat. Now, for nearly 100 years, 90-odd years, I guess, Turkey had been a very secular state. That's deliberate. A form of government was set up back in 1923 by a guy called Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. Atatürk's just a sort of a nickname, means father of the Turks. The guy was a great guy. He did not like Islam in terms of running the country. He thought it was fine in terms of personal beliefs and devotions, but he believed that Islam was keeping the nation poor. Probably right. So he said, not having it. From now on, the state, the government, will be secular. It will not be Islamic. And so he set up a form of government that was secular, and that's been well-liked, well-respected, and a great comfort to Western Europe and to America ever since. But it's all changing. In the last 2 or 3 years, there's been a massive shift back to Islam in Turkey. Its current president, Mr. Recep Erdogan, E-R-D-O-G-A-N, is a devout Muslim.
Wow.
And he has a vision, strangely enough. His vision is of converting the Turkish government and state back to Islam. And he's been busy changing academia, the government, the military, to bring Islam back as a major ruling force. Now, Mr. Kemal Atatürk set up the military deliberately to intervene and sort of, restore secular rule if ever Islam got too much power. And they attempted to do that in July this year. You may remember the Turkish coup in July. Wasn't it a very good one? Utterly failed. The military were sort of going out to try and say, no, the state has to be reset to be secular. We don't like the way Mr. Erdogan's changing things, so we're going back. And, of course, he failed. Or they failed, sorry. Now Mr. Erdogan has become super-duper victorious. He's exclaimed that the coup was, in fact, a gift from God. And since then, he's been busy purging everybody left, right and centre who disagrees with his vision. So since July, somewhere between 80,000 to 100,000 individuals have been suspended or jailed, including thousands of judges, thousands of military, thousands of professors and academic people. And he shows all the signs of bringing in an Islamic dictatorship. After a century of what you might class as modern, secular democracy. And it's becoming evident to lots of people. That's why the Americans are quietly moving their nuclear bombs out of Turkey. They don't like the way it's going. And this past week, Der Spiegel magazine, that's a German weekly magazine, Der Spiegel, its cover story has a picture of Mr. Erdogan and a few missiles going off in the background. And it says, Turkey is a country which has lost its freedom. And they've identified Mr. Erdogan, President Erdogan, as a dictator. So that's caused a bit of a rumpus this week between Germany and Turkey, because saying the president is a despot, a dictator, and the country is no longer a free country, that's a shift. So Turkey has changed dramatically, almost before our eyes. And I think it's possible that Mr. Erdogan could be the notable horn of the he-goat. That depends when these events take place. If it's the next 5, 10, 15 years, I think that's quite possible. If it's way after that, then obviously he might be dead by then. So what you see in Daniel 8, we see Iran and Turkey engaging in major warfare in the end time, which will have massive impact worldwide because it's all around the Persian Gulf area. The oil is everywhere there. You and I would not escape the effects of that. So as of this year, I mean 2016, as of this year alone, with Iran's extra billions of dollars, thank you, Mr. Obama, and Turkey's completely dramatic shift towards the restoration of the Ottoman Empire, the scene is set. I'm going to suggest again that where we should be looking is not Rome, but is actually the Islamic countries of the Middle East. I would watch those if I were you. Okay, that'll do us for today, so we'll conclude the Bible study at this point.